every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me. You're the other night. He says sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With the demons around all around to bring me down to negative or deep. But I believe, yes, I believe, I see that I believe. I'm sending my home to feed, won't be brought down on one knee. I fight with all my might and get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright and I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright and I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight unto the heights. Crown heights, you're burning up all through the twilight. So I thank you to my God, and I finally got it right. Now I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my might. And what's this feeling? My love will rip a hole in the ceiling. Giving myself to you now.
Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Binall of BinallofAmerica.com with the return of Binall of America Audio Season 1. That's right, we're back. We're back from our mid-season hiatus. Did you miss me? I missed you. This week, we return to action with Melinda Leslie. I've wanted to have Melinda Leslie on the program since I first saw her at the X Conference in Washington, D.C. I knew, I was like, I have to interview this woman. Her research is fascinating. And so as Binall of America Audio progressed and grew, I kept glancing at my list of guests that I wanted. I knew Melinda Leslie was on there, and I finally got a chance to track her down during the mid-season hiatus. And now we're bringing to you a two-part interview with Melinda Leslie talking about covert intelligence involvement in ET abductees. This is just fascinating stuff. For those of you unfamiliar with Melinda Leslie, here's a little bit about her. She has investigated covert intelligence involvement in abductions for 12 years, conducting over 40 interviews of experiencers and researchers of this troubling phenomenon. For many years, Melinda was the director of two experiencer support groups and the director of a monthly lecture series for 9 years, presenting nearly 100 speakers. Melinda was associate producer of the 1994 UFO Expo West conferences, has lectured on her area of expertise at numerous conferences, and has been a guest on many radio and television talk shows. And now, of course, she's on Binall of America Audio. Ladies and gentlemen, the wait is over. Binall of America Audio returns with Melinda Leslie.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Binall of America Audio, and I'm excited to bring to you this week Melinda Leslie. Personally, for me, I discovered Melinda Leslie at the X Conference 2 in Washington. It was an awesome presentation, and I was completely blown away. I just could not even imagine, and I hadn't really heard of her yet. And then since then, that was last April, since then, I've come to find out that a lot of people know about Melinda Leslie and her research, and she's very well respected in the field. And when I started putting together Binall of America Audio, she was on the top of the list. So welcome to the show, Melinda, and thank you for the interview.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Why don't we start off with just your bio here, like just tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're doing in the field, how you got into it. It says you've been involved in abductions for 12 years and interviewed over 50 experiencers and researchers of the phenomenon. And I'd say your specialization is covert intelligence involvement in abductions.
That's right.
But tell us a little bit about like where you came from and everything and how you got into studying this.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's actually a long story. But I suppose that the – see if I can give a Reader's Digest condensed version. First off, I have a regular background and work as an office manager and executive assistant and have experienced a variety of fields in the past. So this isn't, my career or anything. anyone who's involved in the UFO field knows you spend money doing it, you don't make money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Unfortunately, but that's the case. And you spend quite a bit of money doing the research. My involvement in this particular subject matter started with, I had an interest my whole life, but since I was in high school, in the paranormal and studying it pretty heavily.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who had these same interests, who I met through an organization group many, many years ago, had turned me on to a radio program in 1989. And at the time, she was into Native American stuff. Oh, gosh, I'm giving the long version. I'm so short of the stuff.
Don't worry about it.
She was into Native American stuff. And this radio show was talking about Native American things, and all of a sudden switched subject matter. And she told me about it, thinking I might have an interest. And truth is, I didn't really have an interest in the UFO subject. My only interest in it was more of a spiritual context of channeled messages, that kind of stuff, if you will. And if anything, I had a little bit of a negative interest in it. But she told me, hey, you know, check out this radio program. It's really interesting. And, I mean, this was like, you know, within a week of it switching subject matter, she instantly told me to check it out. Well, what was happening on this radio program at the time, it was called Billy Goodman's The Happening.
Yes.
And you may have heard of it. And it was the beginning of the whole Lazar story breaking. It was 89, I want to say it was, I think, July, if I remember correctly. Apparently, starting in about June, Bob Lazar had taken John Lear and I guess George Knapp out to see these craft that were flying, or according to him, being test flown every Wednesday. And they went on this radio program and started to talk about, this was long before Lazar ever did. It started with, I think, it started actually with Bill Cooper, who at the time was friends with John Lear, and then John Lear himself going on at Bill's request and the radio host's request. Anyway, so they were first talking about the story. And John had mentioned about going out there and having these sightings. Well, the radio show decided to put a trip together and for people to go out there. On a last-minute fluke, this friend of mine and I, who would take camping trips and often go to Sedona, Arizona, as an example.
Yeah.
We had been overdue. We had not gone camping in like a year, and she said, you know, we've been talking about it. She said, let's go here and join up with these people.
Oh, boy.
And so on a total fluke, we went out there and to what is now known as Area 51 and the Black Mailbox and Mailbox Road and the town of Rachel and et cetera, et cetera. And we had we didn't necessarily think we're going to have a sighting. We thought we were going out there with a bunch of, you know, like-minded people, and we're going to meditate and, you know, look at the stars. And, you know, we didn't really expect anything to happen. And, of course, it did. And we had sightings, and the radio show had two busloads of people out there.
Oh, boy.
And there ended up being, you know, approximately 80 people or so, maybe more. Huh. And the buses had taken off earlier. Well, when we got there, they were first there, but then they left. Anyways, and the remaining people stayed around and agreed that we had the minimum number that we agreed on was about 15 good sightings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and over a period of about 3 hours, from when the bus left to going into about 2 or 3 in the morning. So over a period of about 3 or 4 hours, we had agreed on that. And then we ended up spending the night out there, actually, at the location. And we were so excited by what we saw and totally blown away that we went back 2 weeks later. And we live in Southern California, so going to the middle of Nevada, you know, it's a little bit of a doing. We went back 2 weeks later because we were so excited, and then we went back like a month after that. So basically in a two-month period, we had been out there 3 times and had good sightings each time and had joined up with other people out there. And like I said, had sightings each time. Well,
now, hold on. Let me just... Now,
sure.
You never got harassed by security or anything while you went out there?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I've been out there many times since, and I've even taken some groups of people. So, you know, the white Broncos pull up and, you know, that kind of thing.
And they don't chase you off or anything?
No.
Okay.
Where we're going, if you're at the Black Mailbox, you're in a public place. As long as you're not blocking the road, you know, they won't hassle you. I mean, I've been out there many times. If anything, they've warned us or checked in us, but they've never made us go. It's never been a problem.
Okay. All right.
And I know people who have even gone down the road and everything, and it's not been a problem. If you go far enough to where the signs are, they will ask you to leave. But usually when they ask you to leave, you do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Kind of a thing. I've not gone to that point where I've been asked to leave. I have been there, but not when there's been security around. I've actually been with people who've hiked up into the local hills. A couple of groups over the years kind of been somewhat famous for having had done that, and I was with some of those at different times, and when Glenn Campbell used to live out there, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but anyways, long story short is, you know, been up on the hills and where you can see the base from up on the hill. You're quite a distance away, but you can technically see it. But again, and saw the cameras on the hill and the detection devices. There's all sorts of electronic equipment up there, you know, so they know you're there. But again, never had anything happen. Now, I know other people that have had cameras confiscated and, you know, and some of the stories you've heard, I'm sure. And I know some people, people I know pretty well who have had some pretty interesting stuff along that lines. But long story short is those first three times going that back in 89, starting in, I think the first time we went was August. I said July, but that was incorrect. I think it was August. So August, September into October. So actually over a three-month period, we'd been there three times. And had these sightings, and something about having these sightings, you know, changed my belief system instantly overnight.
Oh, yeah.
It was, you know, first off, okay, UFOs exist, you know, okay, without a doubt, I'm seeing them. I'm seeing things that defy gravity, defy physics as I knew it, and I was out there with some physicists on one trip, another trip some astronomers, and, you know, so I knew it wasn't any of that, you know, qualified witnesses. And so I, you know, so it's like it defied, you know, physics as I knew it. And then also that the government knew about it, you know, because these things were flying in and out of a known base.
Yeah.
It was clear that this was an active military and scientific installation based upon the signs and, you know, you know, everything about it. I mean, you know, and here they were flying in and out. And as they were flying, and these things would drop out of the sky like a falling leaf, stop on a dime, do right angle turns, shoot off like a shooting star, and, you know, I mean, it was clearly not conventional aircraft. I mean, I've seen all sorts of conventional aircraft out there, too. I've also seen stealth aircraft out there. But in this case, these things were totally defying physics in the way they were flying. I mean, to go like a shooting star, stop, and make right angle turns, like zip, stop, zip, stop, zip, stop, you know, it's nuts. And very, very unusual. And there were also helicopters in the air at the same time these other things were. So you had these things zipping around, and yet you had this and orange and white colored glowing objects or lights and small disc shapes kind of stuff. And then you also had helicopters in the air at the same time.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and so something about seeing these, and on the third trip, we actually saw a rather large craft. Now, I don't know how big it was, night, we couldn't tell the whole shape, but it had a circle of lights on what appeared to be like the bottom of it, and a couple people had some telescopes, and with the telescopes, you could clearly make out the lights that were on the bottom of this thing, like a circle of individual lights.
Yeah.
And that last time, which was in October, quite a few people were out there and saw this. And apparently with good binoculars and telescopes, you could clearly make out the circle of lights. And so that was very interesting. But these three times going out there, first off, changed my belief system, like, as I said, where I said, okay, I know they exist. And the government knows about it. And something about that unlocked something in my memory that in between those trips, not so much after the first one, but after the second and third trip in September, October, I started to have dreams at night where I was remembering childhood experiences, which turned out to be abduction experiences. Mm-hmm. And I was not dreaming about, like, things I never knew about before. It was like going back and remembering things I already knew about, like an experience as a child where I had been put down for a nap one afternoon. Everyone had left. One adult stayed at the house with me. This was out in the desert in Southern California. My grandmother had a place. And everyone had left, and this little house she had was in the middle of nowhere in the desert. And late afternoon, put down for a nap, woke up by what I thought were little kids who came to the bedroom window and wanted me to go out and play.
Yeah.
And I always had this memory of being woken up and kind of sneaking out with this adult being asleep. Well, suddenly I'm having this again, but this is happening, this is happening at night.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm asleep. So I'm like, why am I dreaming about this, And then another experience where I also remembered something that happened as a child. So suddenly I'm having these dreams about abductions I had had as a child. So in this 3-month period, and it just, like I said, something unlocked in my brain, and I started to have this. Then a couple months after the third time of having a sighting out there, I had a present day abduction, where it wasn't a dream about something that happened to me previously in life, but it was a current, thing.
Oh, man, yeah.
And I had met in these trips out there some researchers. Long story short, as a researcher had introduced me to another abductee, and another researcher had linked me up with a hypnotherapist that he thought I should see.
Yeah.
And over a period of time, so I'm trying to condense this down but over a period of time, I had current time experiences. So we're talking we're going into 1990 here, 1990, had current time experiences, and late 1990, finally got the courage after almost a year to finally go see this hypnotherapist for regression. But I'd already had conscious memory, and I just went to her saying, okay, obviously this isn't happening. Obviously I'm losing my mind and I'm a sexy, and can you refer me to a psycho, she was a psychotherapist. I said, maybe I need a psychiatrist. Maybe I need to be prescribed something. I have a chemical imbalance, whatever. And I went to her very skeptical of what I was experiencing and remembering. Even some of these, for instance, in 1990, some of these were things that I had, I'd go to bed, wake up the next morning with a scar I'd never had before.
Yeah.
A healed scar where I'd never had one. Waking up with multiple bruises on my body, as well as the memories of being on a ship and seeing grays and stuff, But I'm like, no explanation for how I had a scar appear. No explanation for how bruises or cuts or needle marks may have appeared. And I was getting these things fairly regularly, And with physical evidence, I had a roommate who had witnessed my being gone when I thought I'd been home. I knew I had about 2.5 hour period of missing time. She went looking for me, basically went in my room. My light was on in my room, but I wasn't there. I was never aware of being gone. And then later she told me and actually drew a picture of an alien that she said she had seen in the hallway.
Oh, man.
And so I had a roommate witness I was gone during a period of missing time and witness an alien in the home during, my experience. And I had a memory of that experience as well as bruises. So, we're talking witness
so
missing time, multiple forms of physical evidence, that kind of thing. So, and all these things were happening. And, so I went to this therapist and she said, well, let's see what's going on. And I started to work with her. But like I said, it started with the conscious memory, which led me to go, okay, I need help. I'm not dealing with this as well as I want to. You really question reality and I thought, well, obviously this can't be happening. I must be losing my mind. And so that's how my interest in the abduction subject started, is I started self-investigating my own experiences. And then over time, I met other researchers and other abduction experiencers and formed relationships and got involved in a support group kind of thing. And as I knew researchers, they were connecting me up with other people. So I started to really become an alien abduction researcher. Besides an experiencer, I started to actually become a researcher. And and in 91 had an experience where myself and two male friends were driving somewhere over kind of a mountain highway. We had driven it before and driven it since. We knew exactly, you know, give or take half an hour, how long it should take. And we had an experience one night where it took about 2.5 hours longer than it ever should have.
Oh.
You know, so we were missing at least 2 and maybe as much as 3 hours of missing time.
Yeah.
And at least 2 and, like I said, as much as 3. And the three of us had all sorts of odd physical things, as well as some memory right away, some trauma right away, you know, different things that suggested that something major had happened. And all three of us, we kind of, long story short, we'd all kind of become researchers and knowledgeable, and so we knew not to talk to each other about it. We all went and sought out hypnotherapy separate from each other, but with the same hypnotherapist who was working with our case. And that hypnotherapist said that each of us, we learned this later, she didn't tell us this right away, but apparently each of us remembered seeing this guy in military uniform in the background during our experience.
Okay.
And that was in 91. In 93, so I'm jumping ahead, in 93, yep. I had an experience that was fully being abducted by what appeared to be military and covert intelligence types for the sake of being interrogated about my alien experiences. And that happened in 93. And anyway, so subsequently, my abduction research kind of took a turn and started to incorporate, again, because I started self-investigating what was going on with this military involvement stuff. And I was having black helicopter harassment, mail tampering, phone harassment, you know, interrupted phone calls, and like I said, black helicopter flyovers that were illegally marked, helicopters flying illegally low, circling continually or hovering over me. I mean, and this kind of stuff started happening. And as I started to self-investigate, I started to ask other researchers and other abductees if they were familiar with this, if they had ever had this happen, and started to find out, yes, that in fact they were familiar with it, both the researchers and the abductees. And then I met Carla Turner along the way, and she said, you know, you must talk about this. And she really encouraged me to go forward with the research. You know, she was, of course, has passed away now, but when she was still alive, we were friends, and she encouraged me to really go forward with this research. And she was so brave and outspoken about it that, you know, she was quite a role model for me to be willing to, you know, stand up for this subject. And since it's become very important, and I've brought it to the attention of other researchers who are now, because of the work I'm doing with it, taking the subject much, you know, more seriously as far as its overall significance, because it has a significance to a whole bunch of areas of understanding in the UFO research arena. You know, of course, it has a great implication for abductions. I mean, it means not only are abductions very real, but they're a matter of national security, enough that agencies are willing to spend time, energy, and money on their investigation, harassment, surveillance, you know, of the abductees. But that also it has a lot to do with understanding the nature of the cover-up and why that is. It has everything to do with understanding the technology and reverse engineering the technology and the history of crash retrievals and where that technology development has gone. You know, it's linked to all these things. And it's taken a while to kind of, you know, bend the ear of the UFO community, but it's starting to happen.
Well, that's good. So it's been sort of a natural progression from just your abduction experiences, and then your own, like you said, your own self-investigation.
Yes.
And now you've sort of carved out this niche that is this the Black Ops re-abductions.
Yeah, and it wasn't like I set out to do it. I mean, I was just self-investigating my own alien abductions, then had this other weird stuff happen, and started to ask questions about, well, what was that, and why was that, and with the military and intelligence involvement, and then kind of that rolled, you know, I had initially been asked maybe to lecture a few places about my alien experiences, and before I knew it, I was incorporating this stuff, and I was meeting other people who had had these kind of things happen, and I was outspoken, and like I said, was encouraged by Carla to go for it, and you know, and it wasn't like I ever said, "Oh, I'm going to research this." It just kind of happened as a byproduct of my having experiences.
All right. Now, one thing I kind of noticed because I was watching your the DVD of your presentation at the X conference.
Sure.
And the term that's used a lot is "my lab." Now, you didn't use it as much as I would think, because that's sort of your whole area of research.
Mm-hmm.
The actual word "my lab," do you shy away from that? What do you think of that sort of classification?
I mean, you may know this, but I'll share this for your, you know, listeners, that Katarina Wilson, an abductee who's written rather extensively about her own experiences, wrote a book called Alien Jigsaw. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was in that book that she first mentioned the term "my lab." And "my lab" was her acronym for military, M-I-L, and abduction, A-B. So it was military abduction. And so she coined the term. And then Helmut Lammer, a researcher from Austria, I'm not sure how he necessarily got onto the subject, but he was researching the subject and wrote a book called "My Labs," but gave Katarina, you know, credit for that's where the term was coined. And it just is an acronym for military abduction, but it takes, when you say it, it takes explaining it. And so I it's not that I shy away from using it, it's just sometimes I don't want to have to explain military abduction, what "my lab" means.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll just say military abduction or covert intelligence involvement, because I, rather than have to say "my lab" and then explain it, I just give the explanation without the acronym. You know, and it simplifies things.
Yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with the term, and it's becoming known in the UFO arena because of Katarina and Helmut
and your work,
Carla, and my work, and
So with these military abductions, they're occurring. I wanted to know if it's like a recurring process where there's like an abduction. Well, let me start out actually. Let's just get to your basic thesis: is that the government, in the form of black ops, is abducting people after they've been abducted by ETs.
Yes. And it's not just the abduction. It's a whole gamut of involvement. It can start with low-grade surveillance of the abductee, progress to maybe some harassment, to being approached, to being monitored, to having their life maybe manipulated or influenced in some way, and then actually progress from there. Those are the first couple levels, and then progress to actually being re-abducted. And again, there's nothing in these people's lives to warrant this kind of interest from the government. These are usually people who are average in every way and usually hold average jobs and have families and everything about them is normal in the general context of the word, except for the fact that they've had abductions. I mean, this is the cross, gamut of abductees. One thing is it tends to show over time and with research that there tends to be a higher level of I was going to say intelligence, but I won't say that. That's not fair. But a higher level of education amongst abductees in general. But that's a very general term because, of course, abductions now happen all over the world and in every culture. And some of those are third world and poor cultures and stuff. But in the U.S., it seems that in general it tends to be. It's not your hick out in the field, even though that's often, unfortunately, portrayed, at least with sightings and stuff. But with abductions, it tends to be kind of a not only general populace, but an educated general populace. And with the MyLab stuff, it tends you know, to be those abductees who maybe fit certain scenarios. And I've come across some patterns, which I'm sure we'll get into later. But then, like I said, they have the where they're picked up, usually to be interrogated about their alien experience. Quite often, it's to be warned off or warned away from going public or talking about it, kind of a thing. That happens a lot. And then, so that's usually some involvement in the, you know, interrogations slash debriefing, if you will.
Yeah.
And then there's also where they're actually questioning you, and there's a couple of different patterns that come up there, but the two most prominent ones are alien motives and alien technology. Those are the two things that come up the most,
yeah.
Where they're interested in what we might know about why are the aliens here, what are they doing, you know, their motives,
mm-hmm.
why are they abducting people, you know.
Yeah.
And also, you know, why are they here in general, but also then the technology, you know, what have we seen, have we had hands-on, have we been shown technology, do we have any of it, do we know how to operate it, you know, these
yeah.
kind of things come up quite a bit. And then there's some other things to a lesser degree, but certainly there's a follow-up of medical procedures. They're often investigating, for instance, if you just had an alien abduction, they're maybe looking to see what did the aliens do to you medically. What is it about you medically or genetically that's of interest to the aliens? And then they're also, they being humans, are also looking at that. And you think, okay, well, this would end with this re-abduction scenario. No, this is about the middle
oh,
of
really?
The list of things that happen. Because then what happens is a deepening monitoring of someone's life. Then what can happen is you can be befriended by an insider who's either trying to steer you away from the subject or is trying to steer you in a particular direction within the subject, like supportive, but in a kind of a manipulative way.
Yeah, these are the minders you talk about.
Yeah, exactly. And controlling and manipulating. And then they can control and manipulate your life, affect your finances, your work, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You can be befriended by someone where you actually get an emotional relationship with them, dating or even marrying someone who is either who may be an insider or someone who has influence in that way.
Wow.
And so there's these deepening, you know, levels of involvement that
yeah.
go even beyond the re-abduction scenario. And some people have quite a lot of this influence happening in their life. And some abductees just have some phone stuff and never have anything else, or just have a helicopter fly over, or maybe mail tampered with, or maybe a combination of that, and don't have anything else. It seems like, you know, if you have some aspect of that, you're more likely to have more, and you're more likely to have more, and, you know, so
yeah.
with each level, it's more likely you're to have the next deepening levels.
Yeah.
And once someone has had the re-abduction scenario and the interrogation, that kind of stuff, it's more likely that they're going to have the other parts. But even with that, you know, I know of some people that have even had the re-abduction, the interrogation, the medical procedures, but haven't had the control and manipulation and the deepening monitoring. It seems to be that control and manipulation happens to be with the people who maybe have the most amount of influence or known in the UFO community or are more likely to go public or who have gone public. Not with the re-abduction stuff and not with the other levels. That can happen to even people who haven't gone public. But it seems to be that the deepening, influencing, manipulating, monitoring kind of stuff happens to be with the more
prominent
public you are.
Okay, so now just to jump back a little bit, when the people get abducted, sometimes they start experiencing this harassment from the government. Like, they don't come like before they've even told anybody really that they were abducted.
Yeah.
This isn't like they're, you know, the government's waiting outside in the parking lot of like Bud Hopkins or something.
Yeah, no.
You know?
No. quite often it's these abductees, like you just said, haven't even told anyone, aren't even sure themselves. You know, a lot of times the abductee, if you ask the abductee, are you an abductee, they may be in denial and flat out say, well, no, or, you know. So, you know, a lot of times, again, the people don't even know themselves that they're an abductee. And if they do or they have some sense that they're starting to put it together, a lot of times the abductees don't even necessarily relate it to their experience. What makes them related is sometimes this harassment surveillance stuff seems to happen right after an abduction or subsequent to, you know, in other words, if not the same day, if not within a couple days, within a couple weeks, or within a couple months, you know, but you kind of, they kind of see, and especially if more than one incident of some kind happened, they then draw a correlation. But I've had some abductees have some low-grade harassment and not necessarily connect it to their abduction. I mean, I've had people approach me after I've lectured and stuff and say, well, you know, I'm an abductee, and I've also had this other thing, but I never knew that they were connected.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they may not be. I mean, you know, there could be other reasons for involvement in your life, but I usually, you know, I would then ask someone, you know, do you have any other reasons for this interest? And, you know, with the exception of maybe some extremely rare accounts, the answer is no, they don't have anything going on. And it does seem to be timed in relationship to their abduction, especially the re-abduction, the being, you know, picked up and interrogated and stuff. That seems to happen, you know, subsequent to an alien abduction within a short period of time after an alien abduction.
So the government knows these people were abducted, like, before they know. So therefore the government must know the ETs are...
I thought, well, this is only happening to people who are going public or have talked about it or are starting to talk about it or, you know, talking amongst their family or their friends. And at first I thought that, but then when I started to meet people where that wasn't the case and hadn't talked to their family or friends or hadn't, you know, and then it started to be like, well, why are they having this happen? And I had to then re-examine that and say, well, okay, you know, how might they know that this person is an abductee? And what I started to realize was, well, maybe there's ways that they know that abductions are happening without them finding out from the abductees. In other words, you know, you go back to the original theories and ideas of, was there some kind of agreement, you know, with the government, do the aliens provide them some information? Okay, I don't know that, but I won't rule it out, you know?
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, well, if that's not the case, what else is there? And then I came across over the years a couple different things that could suggest there's ways that they know. One is, as an example, that they could be monitoring the coming and going ships, you know, and if there is ships returning to a particular area on a regular basis, then that might suggest that there's abductions in that area, or if they actually are monitoring the coming and going from a single location, and, you know, that kind of thing. And what I came across was, for instance, that there was a spy satellite that a gentleman by the name of Ron Roger worked in helping develop, and specifically developing the information retrieval system for retrieving information from this one particular satellite. And he's gone public, kind of a whistleblower, if you will, talking about how the spy satellite tracks what the government officially calls fast walkers, which are these seemingly intelligently controlled objects coming in from deep space or near space into our atmosphere at a fast rate of speed, and that these aren't meteors or anything else. You know, I mean, you know, he was saying that these things are under intelligent control, and that this particular spy satellite just by chance was picking these things up from time to time. And he did some real research to correlate these things with any known sightings. And your listeners may be familiar, and you're probably familiar with a famous Iranian pilot incident of an Iranian pilot coming close contact and chasing down a Iranian fighter pilot chasing down a UFO, and it's a famous sighting and incident and you know, recorded and known UFOlogy. Well, he was able to track that that the spy satellite tracked the object that the Iranian fighter pilot chased and, you know, and witnessed, and I think other pilots too, but that this was one of the objects that the DSP spy satellite saw come in from deep space.
Oh, man.
And so, yeah, so suddenly you go, wait a second, this is one spy satellite that just happens to be catching these things? And then you kind of scratch your head and you go, well, wait a second. Okay, is it actually got equipment on it to design to track these things?
Yeah.
This is a spy satellite with other purposes, too. Maybe they've put up satellites designed just for tracking these things.
Exactly, yeah.
And how many satellites are up there? And how many satellites are catching them by chance? How many satellites are up there designed to do this? And if this one is picking these things up on a regular basis by chance, it's easy to extrapolate almost mathematically out of the number of satellites up there, how many are getting them by chance and how many might actually be up there specifically to do this? And suddenly you go, oh, my God, these guys being the covert ops, you know, the government, the part that is involved with the alien scenario or reversing the technology, you know, reverse engineering the technology, doing crash retrievals, that whole cabal, if you will,
the people who
obviously knows what's coming and going a lot better than we've ever given them credit for.
Yeah.
And then you go to the space shuttle missions, you know, STS-78, STS-40, there's a couple others I'm not remembering off the top of my head, but, you know, these space shuttle missions that have caught craft coming into our atmosphere and maneuvering in strange ways and focusing in on them, and this, you know, space shuttle footage that before it was scrambled and they used to be able, you know, people used to be able to retrieve it, and some that's also been leaked out, you know, and you just go, okay, the shuttle's catching these things. So suddenly, you know, you just add these two together and you go, you know, I bet they're tracking these things, again, much better than we've ever given them credit for doing. So if they're tracking these things, do they know that any are going repeatedly to a location? You know, are they looking for that? I mean, if they're able to now, with spy, you know, satellites, find something the size of a quarter from space, or maybe I'm being generous, let's even say the size of a basketball, which, you know, this is all in the literature, you know?
Yeah.
And seeing great detail down to that size, then tracking a craft coming in to its ultimate location would be easy, huh?
Yeah.
You know, kindergarten spy satellite stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, it's reasonable to say, okay, they know that these things are coming and going, and other equipment on the ground that may be tracking them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if they feel that one is going to a location, they might then be monitoring stuff with that environment. Are there any strange energetic things going on with that environment that maybe they know that there's a residual effect after abductions or after sightings, and maybe they're able to monitor that residual with, you know, with technology? Are they monitoring the phones to see if somebody's talking about it? Are they monitoring the sound in that environment, whether it's bugged or from parabolic mic or something, you know, to monitor somebody, you know, talking about, you know, so all this together, you start to go, it would actually be pretty easy for them, if they're doing any of this at all, it would be easy for them to know who might be abducted. Now, not that they know who everyone is, but that they might be looking for people that match a list of certain criteria.
Yeah, they could find abductees if they wanted to look for them.
Mm-hmm. And that criteria, again, being, is this an abductee who's had a lot of experiences? Is this someone who's had a varied amount of experiences? In other words, is this abductee someone who might know about alien motives? I mean, do they seem to have some kind of ongoing relationship in a way where maybe this is an abductee who would be a good person for information? And then, is this an abductee who's had any technical experience? Not only in their life, that's separate, but, you know, but also, is this an abductee who has mentioned something, anything about seeing technology or experiencing it? You know, they might be looking for that. And I think that's why some abductees just have low-grade harassment surveillance. I think this is the beginning of them checking you out, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Low-grade harassment surveillance, but never have anything else. Well, guess what? You didn't match their criteria. And probably your low-grade harassment surveillance fell off over a period of time, months or years, you know. But, and let's say you have that, but you have more of it. Well, then you they're looking at you a little deeper, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, and they're not actually going to spend the time and spend the money, per se, to carry out a full operation to re-abduct you unless they really think you have something they want.
Yeah.
But if you have something they want or they think you do, and I tell abductees, and when abductees have met me and said, you know, gosh, I have seen technology, and I've had a hands-on with the technology, and I have a background in military, and, you know, and my father was in the aerospace. You know, all these things that start to match, which I haven't gotten into, but all these things that start to match, you know, the criteria for likeliness, I tell them, I say, you know, fasten your seatbelt. I expect that more will happen to you. I said, hopefully not. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. But you match the criteria for people who do have the reabduction, you know. And so far, I haven't really heard back from anyone who's contacted me and said, oh, my God, you're right. But I'd have to think about that. I'd almost have to go back and review some notes and some tapes to see if you know, maybe that's right. Now, I have worked with people who have had subsequent stuff after working with me or after talking to me, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'll hear from them out of the blue, and sometimes I worry when I hear a familiar voice on the phone. I'm like, you know, because I think, oh, God, did something happen to them recently? And sometimes they'll start going, I had to call you. I just had something happen.
No,
like, no. Oh, God. You know.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I'm there for them to talk to.
Yeah, well, I mean, someone needs to be collecting this information and trying to synthesize it into something, you know, because it's it's a less spoken of aspect of abductions.
Yeah, it certainly is. And to me, it's such an important aspect, and I'll tell you why. First off, you know, in abductions, in everything UFOlogy, you know, we're looking for that elusive evidence, you know.
Yeah.
And here you have something that provides such strong evidence for not only the reality of alien abduction, but also the possible meaning of alien abduction and the fact that abductions are so important that on some level they're a matter of national security.
Yes.
And why is it? What is it about abductions? You know, so I can look at this both ways. I can say, okay, I can understand their interest in what they want to know. We almost have to, reverse engineer from the field to look back and say, what can we tell based upon their interest? And suddenly, some things start to lay out and start to make sense. You know, I can look back and go, okay, well, obviously, all their interest in the technological aspect is what do I know about how they've developed the technology and how far are they along with that technology and what are their remaining questions? What are the areas that they might be working on with the reverse engineering of the technology based upon what they're asking the abductees?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and I start to come up with some stuff,
yeah.
You know, and it starts to be like, okay, well, based upon what's happening to the abductees, we know something. You start to be able to know what's going on with the cover-up. Where is it at? What are they doing? What are they working on?
Mm-hmm.
What are they working towards?
Based
upon their interaction with the abductees. So getting back to what you said, I think it's an extremely important aspect because it provides us with another way to look at the information, to draw conclusions and draw theories and, you know,
yeah.
Because it shows a roadmap for some of these things. And so not only is it really strong evidence for abduction itself, so it's significant within the abduction field because it's such strong supporting evidence. Of course, if abduction, you know, I don't know if you're familiar and your listeners are familiar with the Roper poll, but there was a Roper poll conducted, paid for by the Bigelow Foundation, that was headed up by some of the major abduction researchers who tacked on questions within the Roper poll. And it wasn't, are you an abductee? You know, these were questions like, one question was, have you ever had a period of missing time of an hour or more where you or others didn't know where you were? That was one of the questions. Well, they came up with like 10 key indicator questions, of which of which five they felt were extremely significant. And if you answered yes to four or five out of the five, so in other words, they didn't even count your response unless you answered yes to all five, basically.
Yeah.
And answering yes to all five, what the ROPA poll came back with numerically was the representation of the populace was 3,700,000.
Oh, wow.